Okay. All right, guys. We have Parshas Miketz. We have some Chanukah. We'll split our time. I guess mostly Miketz, but a little bit of Chanukah as well. We'll start with the story of Chanukah just because it's a cute and deep story and one that you could share easily at the table wherever you may be. And I think most of you will be here for Shabbos.
A lot of guys are going out for Shabbos on Shabbos.
Okay,
so I'm going to Shabbos lunch. That's why I need something to get a grab at.
I got
the poison of the blood.
I got
the poison of the blood was once approached by a group of Jews that were being harassed by a certain unsavory individual. He was fabricating stories about them and reporting them to authorities for things that, for crimes they've never committed. He was making fun of him. He was doing all sorts of treachery and trickery to try to get them to cease and desist from serving Hashem. He was just really a pain in their side. And eventually they couldn't take it anymore. They decided to go to the Chozeh Milubin, the Holy Chozeh, and ask him if he could please, I don't know to use the word curse this individual, but somehow see to it that this individual stopped from hindering them and disturbing them.
Was this guy Jewish, this individual that was disturbing them?
So they went to the Chozeh. These are all questions to the end. And in general, on Hasidic Shemai says you can never ask questions anymore. They went to the Chozeh. They wrote down the name, as is the custom, to write down the name on a piece of paper. They showed it to the Chozeh, and the Chozeh said, something's wrong. This guy's a tzaddik. This guy lights up the world. So, this guy doesn't light up the world. And they tell him of all the treachery and problems that he's caused. This guy's no tzaddik. But on the other hand, it's the Chozeh. The Chozeh sees, you know what I'm saying? They don't call him seer for nothing. So the Chozeh says, come back later. They came back 3 hours later and he looks at the name and he says, oh yeah, this guy's a Russia. And he does whatever it is that has to be done. Chozeh. David, that they should have Yeshua from this person.
What's Yeshua?
Salvation. So, they try to figure out what went wrong. How come the Chozeh didn't see it? And they realized that the first time they came to the Chozeh, the man was sitting by the light of his menorah. And part of the menorah is such that when you're lighting the Chanukah candles and you're basking by the glow of the light of the candles, then even total Rishayim managed to bring out a certain light into the world. Chanukah always happens in the darkest days of the year, right, when it's most dreary. And it's as if metaphorically to convey to us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes down even to the lowest of the low and tries to raise us up. We light 36 candles on Chanukah, as you are well aware, not counting the Shamash. If you take 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, it equals 36. And that is connected to 36 Masechtas of the Shas. If you have every day you're learning a negative Masechta again, because the Torah has the power to elevate. So tonight, for example, will be 3 candles. Now, from which 3 Masechtas is that tonight?
Mm-hmm.
Missing one between Sachin and Rosh Hashanah. Psachim?
Erevin
was yesterday. Shkalim. Psachim, Shkalim, and Rosh Hashanah is tonight. Alright? So it's a special. Each night has its own Masechta. Each night has the power to elevate. Okay. That's a little bit of a Chanukah story. We'll get back to Chanukah a little bit later. Okay. So we have the following in Pasuk Yud Dalet. Perek Memalev Pasuk Yud Dalet. After Sar Hamashkim says, you know, when I was back in prison, so there was a certain individual there named, he doesn't even give a name, there was a certain individual there, a Hebrew, who was there, who was able, who had power to interpret dreams. Maybe it would be worthwhile for Paro to speak to him, and this individual can help you with your dreams as well. And then at that point it says, Vayishlach Paro Vayikrat Yosef, Paro sent and they called Yosef, Vayaritsuhu Minabor. They didn't just bring him from the pit, but Vayaritsuhu Minabor. That's a little bit weird of a lashon, Vayaritsu. They ran. They quickly grabbed him from the pit. So what does that mean? What do we learn from that? They quickly grabbed him from the pit. So Chafetz Chaim said the following. The Chafetz Chaim said that he was in the pit in prison for 12 years. Right? If you do the cheshbon, he was 30 when he appeared in front of Paro. He spent 1 year by Potiphar, and he spent 12 years in prison. Why 12 years? 1 year for every brother that he spoke against, the Dibara that we saw in last week's Parsha. 1 year for every brother that he spoke against, so that's a total of 10. And then another 2 years for putting his faith in the Saramashkim rather than trusting in God. So a total of 12. However, it points out the Chafetz Chaim, that the minute the 12 years was up, by Himiketz, the minute that 2 years was up after the 10, the minute the 12 years were up, Vayaritsu Minabor, they quickly brought him out of the pit. Get him out immediately. Right? This is reflective of a certain mindset when it comes to punishment. Sometimes people punish out of a sense of cruelty and out of a sense of revenge because their ego has been hurt. You said no to me, I'm going to punish you. You know, they have their ability. Oh, you said no to me, so fine. I have the power, and therefore I can punish you. You know, say no to me, go to your room. The truth is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't, he's not vengeful. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not, HaKadosh Baruch Hu punishes us not out of cruelty, not out of a sense of revenge. HaKadosh Baruch Hu punishes us out of a sense of compassion, not of a sense of helping us. It is what we commonly refer to as tough love. If, let's say, for example, you see a child who's about to stick his wet fingers into a socket, and then you see a parent slapping his hand away, you wouldn't accuse that parent of being cruel. You would say that's an example of tough love. If your best friend is addicted to some sort of destructive drug or smoke or alcohol, and he begs you for a hit or he begs you for a shot of alcohol, and you say no, he says, "Come on, don't you love me?" Your answer would, of course, be, "Yes, I love you, and that is why I am not giving in to your kind." That is its notion of tough love. Punishment as well, if it is a sense of getting a person to rethink about what he did, getting a person to evaluate his and assess his deeds, if it is out of that sense, then of course that punishment is worthwhile. I remember a few years ago, so I was working in camp, it was Camp Stone, and there was a group of kids that went on a raid. The truth is, usually raids in Camp Stone are allowed, but you have to get permission for them first. There's illegal raids with permission, and there is illegal raids without permission. Illegal raids with permission are allowed. Illegal raids without permission, of course, are not allowed. So there's a group of kids that went on a raid, and I was Rosh Moshe at the time, and I decided I would punish them. So I remember at one point during the punishment, the director of the camp, at the time it was not Yehuda, the director of the camp brought them ices, and he gave them ices to eat in the middle of whatever labor tasks they were doing. And I was upset, and I said to him, "I don't understand, why are you giving them ices here? They're supposed to be punished." And he explained to me, he said, "What are you talking about? Punishment is not about making them suffer vengeance and revenge. It's not about you and them. They didn't do anything against you. What you have over here is an opportunity to educate them. There's no point in making them miserable. There's a point to educate them over here. And the ices is not going to educate them any less or any more. If anything, it would educate them more. And so therefore, of course, we should be giving them ices. Game, set, match. Punishment is not about revenge. Punishment, it's about educating. That is why the minute the 12 years was up, Yosef comes out of the pit. It is, Vayaritsuhu minavor. They quickly ran him out of the pit. Yes.
When you say he was there for 12 years, 10 years for his brothers, shouldn't it be 11 for his brothers, since he had 11 brothers, not...
Yeah, but he didn't speak badly about Binyamin.
What do you mean by talking badly, by interpreting the dream, saying, "Oh, these people were bad"?
At the beginning of last week's question, it says, "By Yahweh Yosef is Dibur Samra Laviyam." He used to tell bad actions that they did to their father.
Oh, here's like Sinjan. And what were the other 2 years? He said, 10 for the brothers and 2 for...
Saramashkim and Saramashkim.
What about that? What do you mean
he
by...
He asked Saramashkim to please mention him to Paro when he got out, rather than trusting in the show.
Oh, he asked each of them to mention?
No, well, one of them was being killed.
He
didn't...
No,
Sarah Ofim was being killed. He asked Sarah Mashkin, the butler, who was kept alive. He asked him.
Why 2 years for that?
No, that's a different question. See the Ramban over there. Oh. Okay. Next. When When Yosef speaks to the brother, well, I guess before we get that, Mem Aleph Pasuk Mem Vav. It's an interesting pasuk. It says Yosef solves the dreams. Yosef suggests to him, you know what would be a wise idea for you to do, Mr. Paro, Sir Paro, would be to appoint a person who will collect during the next 7 years. He'll collect the food and he'll build storage houses, etc. So Paro says, who's as wise as you? He appoints him the viceroy of Mitzrayim. He renames him Tzofnat Paaneach. And then the pasuk tells us, Yosef ben Shloshim Shana be'omdol lifnei Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Yosef is 30 years old when he is standing in front of Paro. Vayetze Yosef melifnei Paro ve'avor b'cholat Mitzrayim. Yosef then left Paro and he went throughout the land, throughout all of Egypt. Okay. Question is, though, why does it mention that Yosef was 30 years old? Why is that relevant to us? The Torah doesn't like to mince words, so why does the Torah mention over here that Yosef was 30 years old? So the Rashbam just said, wanted to show us that he was ready for this high position, right? He matured, he was of a certain age, reflected a certain maturity where he can handle such a position. And that too is a lesson to us. Sometimes we try to prematurely push ourselves into places where we don't belong. We might think that we have the answers, we might think that we know what we're doing. After all, we have, you know, whatever many years of experience under our belt, etc. We always think we know. The answer is we don't always know. You have to attain a certain level of proficiency. And just to demonstrate on that, a great example now, I remember when I was, when I came back from my Shana Aleph, Shana Bet, so I went to my sister's house for Shabbos, and I was in the park with my sister and my niece at the time, and my niece ran out of the park and into the street. And my sister started to yell at her, scream at her, and really give it to her. What are you doing? You never run into a street. And she was just yelling at her. And I, of course, thinking that I know it all, said to my sister, I said, nah, but take it easy. Well, you know, me all of 19 years old, having all the parenting advice in the world, what are you doing? Take it easy. She didn't do it on purpose, etc. Why are you getting so angry? And then my sister turned to me, calmly and collected, at which point I realized it was really fake anger. She said to me, what I'm doing is perhaps saving my daughter's and your niece's life. That's what she was doing. She wasn't really angry, but she had to show anger and she had to express it and really convey to a 4-year-old just how dangerous it is to run into the street, and that was the way to do it. I thought I had all the answers. I was like, what are you doing? It seems cool. I didn't have all the answers, right? I was like, right, of course not if I was a parent. So according to the Rashbam, it was just a matter of telling us that he at that point had really been primed and ready for the position and able to handle it. However, the Netziv gives a different interpretation. The Netziv says that the point of the pasuk is not just that he was 30 years old, but that in this 1 year, Vayetze Yosef milifnei paro v'yavar b'chalei etz Mitzrayim, it's the second half of the pasuk, that in this 1 year, in just this 1 year span of time, Yosef was able to travel throughout all of Mitzrayim, assess exactly what was and what wasn't in the fields, and figure out how to set up storage houses. He came up and he conceived the entire plan all within 1 year. And that's an amazing thing, to set up an empire, essentially, the framework for an empire, what would become the greatest empire in those times, in less than a year, shows on Yosef's part a tremendous amount of zrizus, a tremendous amount of, I don't know if you just translate it into English, it shows on his part a tremendous amount of, shows on his a tremendous amount of dedication, a tremendous amount of zeal, a tremendous amount of smarts, everything that one zrizus. This is a tremendous lesson for us. There's two types of zrizus. There is zrizus before you do a mitzvah. There's also zrizus during the mitzvah. For example, sometimes we've all been victims of the notion of you postpone something and then before you know it, the opportunity is gone. Right, in medicine, especially in surgery, there's something called the golden hour. What's the golden hour? After you cut a person open, so you have the incision over there, within a certain amount of time, you want to stitch them up again. If you don't stitch them up during a certain amount of time, then the chances of infectious disease increase tenfold. Right? It's a, if you miss the golden hour, then it becomes a lot harder to provide for a clean and quick recovery. That's the golden hour in surgery. When it comes to mitzvahs, Rav Twersky says, there's also what's called the golden hour. There's an opportune time to do mitzvahs, and you have to anticipate, eagerly await, and do the mitzvahs in the just and good fashion. There's a...
So what does that have to do with them being 30?
There is a story of the Berditchever. The Berditchever of Motzei Pesach. So most of us in Motzei Pesach, what's the first thing we ask the rabbi Motzei Pesach? We ask the rabbi, when can I eat chametz again? Right, that's the one question that everyone gets. In fact, the rabbis don't even wait for that question anymore. They just say, please don't eat your chametz before 10:31 this evening, so that they make sure that they sell that, whatever it is. So that's, the Berditchever was not like this. The Berditchever used to stand up all night on Motzei Pesach, anticipating and waiting for the moment that he can put on this tefillin. For the past week during Chol HaMoed and Sukkot, he did not put on tefillin. There was a certain amount of zrizus, of diligence, of quickness, of anticipation of doing the mitzvah of tefillin. That is a notion of zrizus. He didn't want to miss the opportunity. He didn't want to, let me go to sleep, wake up, and take my time. He wanted to do it zrizus, quickly. That's zrizus before the mitzvah. The truth is there's also mitzvahs during the mitzvah itself, a certain amount of zeal as you perform the mitzvah itself. Sometimes you look at a person and you see the way he's doing a mitzvah. So let's say a person with tefillin. So sometimes a person with tefillin is sitting there like this, and the tefillin are like, the tefillin shel rosh are hanging over his right ear, and the tefillin shel yad are like basically down to his wrist. He's not really focusing on it. Hard to argue if he's even, one might argue he's likely not even being mekamer mitzvah. Then if he's being mekamer tefillin, okay. Let's assume he's mekamer somehow barely mitzvah. But it's ain't a doma to a person who's putting it on and constantly checking to make sure that his tefillin are in the right place and feeling them and caressing them and enjoying them. That's a certain amount of excitement about the mitzvah itself. It's just about the mitzvah itself. Right. And sometimes it works the other way also. Even if you're not excited about doing the mitzvah, if you get yourself excited by doing these actions, you will get excited. If any of you have had occasion to be on a sports team, and you're part of the sports team, so everyone knows that before the game you play loud music and you jump up and down and do layup lines and you run. Why? You psych yourself up. That's what it's called, psych up music. You psych yourself up. You can create a mood by falsely generating it. So that's the notion of zrizus. That is what we learned from Yosef being 30. In that one year, in his 30th year of life, he managed to do all of these, set up the entire infrastructure. The only way he could have done it was with a measure of zrizus, with a measure of diligence and determination. Okay, next.
What does that have to do with Yosef being 30, though?
They said that he did it all in his 30th year of life, in one year.
So, that's why it says 30, to show that he does it in one year?
The focus of the pasuk is not that it says that he's 30, but in this 30th year of life, he did all of this. He passed through all of Eretz Mitzrayim, a very large land, and managed to set up the entire infrastructure. Okay. We skipped one. Since at the beginning of the parsha, so when Paro recounts the dream to Yosef, so what does he say? Right, Paro dreams that he's standing on the Yaor. When he recounts the dream, he tells Yosef, "Bachalomi." Right, in my dream. Pasuk Yudzayin, Hineni Omed al Tzfasa Yaor. I am standing on the Yaor. The Midrash on this pasuk points out the difference between Paro, the evil Paro, the Rasha, and Yaakov, the Tzaddik. The Nile, the Yaor that he's talking about, the Nile River, served to the Egyptians as a guide. And here was Paro standing in the Neomed Ala Yaor. Paro envisioned himself standing above God. As opposed to Yaakov, when Yaakov had the dream, so he dreamed that he was on the bottom of a ladder. And who was on top of the ladder?
Malachim.
The Malachim were going up and down the ladder, but on top of the ladder was Vene Hashem Nitzav Alav. Hashem was on top. That is the basic That the Medrash points out, and it's brought by Rav Sanders and Sefer, that the Medrash points out is the difference between a Rasha and a Tzaddik. A Rasha believes that he stands on top of God, that he can control circumstance. A Tzaddik recognizes that he does not control circumstance, God stands above him. Rav Shwadron used to tell the story, in the old days in Yerushalayim there weren't many streetlights, but the streetlight at the entrance to Yerushalayim that you pass every time when you come up Highway 1 was there. And there used to be an individual that used to stand there. He was slightly disturbed, clearly. And all day, he would direct traffic. He would tell cars, you know, come. He would stop cars from the other direction, and then he would say stop, and then he would stop. But he wasn't really directing traffic. There was a light above of his head, the traffic light, and when it was red, he would put up his hand and say stop. And when it was green to the other side, he would say go. But in his mind, he thought the entire time that he was, in fact, causing the traffic to stop and move. When any sane individual really knows that what? Of course he was doing nothing, it was the light above his head. That's the same way in our Avodas Hashem. Sometimes we think that we are the ones that we are the people that say stop and go, that we run the show. But the fact is that is incorrect. The fact is that in fact the Kadosh Baruch Hu runs the show, and that is the difference between the Tzaddik and the Rasha. The Rasha believes that he stands on top of God and he controls and dictates what will be. And Tzaddik, on the other hand, believes that no, God stands on top of him and he controls the show. Right? The Pasuk in Mishlei say, "V'takel Hashem b'chol libecha ve'el binatcha al tishayim." Trust in Hashem with all of your heart. Do not rely upon your own intelligence. Don't assume that you have all the answers. Don't assume you obviously need the help of God. The Rabbah says that if you freeze out the help of God out of any element of your life, then you really won't help the help. If you say, this I can handle on my own, then God will say, you think you can handle it on your own. So God, try to handle it on your own. And the fact is, we can't always handle it on our own. So that's a dangerous thing to say. I think I might have given an example once when I was in high school. So I remember in Ramaz, the girls' varsity team was undefeated for about 4 years. And they were playing their championship game that evening. And before Mincha, so each class prays Mincha in their own classroom. So the principal of the school, Rabbi Lookstein, got on and he said, I would encourage everyone to please do not forget the girls' basketball team in their tefillah today and insert a special prayer for them in Shema Kaleinu to succeed. And I remember at the time thinking it's funny, alright? It's like, that's so weird, you're really dabbing for a girls' basketball team. But the more and more I thought about it then, and since then, the truth is, there's a certain amount of logic to it. Why should we assume that to freeze God out of any part of our life? Of course God could be involved in another avodah. To say he's not involved is to limit him, and God is limitless. So that is the notion. In the Neomed Ala Yor versus Hashem Nitzav Alav, God stands above us in everything that we do. We do not stand above God at any one point. That is the difference between Paro and Yaakov.
Did they win the championship?
That's irrelevant.
No, but didn't God answer their prayer?
I don't know. I assume they did. I don't know. Okay. Let's skip ahead to the parsha, and then we'll do maybe a 4 night Hanukkah. Pasuk in Perek Mem Gimel, Pasuk Chav Zayin and Chav Ches. So the brothers come back to Mitzrayim, and Yosef asks them, "Hashalom abichena zaken asher amartem, is there peace to your elder father? Ha'odenu chai, is he still alive? Vayomru shalom le'avadecha le'avinu." And they answer him, "Yes, he is at peace. Odenu chai, he is alive." People ask the question, what does that mean? Shalom odenu chai. If he's at peace, isn't he? Right? Doesn't that mean he's alive? Is he peace? Is he having a good day? Yeah, he's having a good day. He's alive. What does that mean? He's having a good day. He's alive. He's at peace. Isn't that somewhat redundant? So the answer is absolutely not. Sometimes we could be at peace, but not be alive. Right? We can live our life comfortably without being alive. We can be what's called comfortably numb. To just go on in our existence, oblivious and unthinking, and just go with the flow. Just enjoy all the fields that life has to offer. But not be alive, not be vibrant. Alive means, Atem Advekim Ba'Hashem Chuyem Kulchem Ayom. Alive means to be cleaving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A person can live his life without HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He can be shalom, but he could. But that does not necessarily mean chai. What Yosef is asking him, is he at peace? Is he able to keep his religious vibrancy even in light of this alleged tragedy that has gripped him with the loss of his son Yosef? Right? Is he still religiously vibrant? That is what, and then we're saying to him, yes, Baruch Hashem, he's shalom, but he's not comfortably numb, he is odenu chai, he is alive. Real life vibrancy can come from a life of religious commitment, is the point that Yosef is trying to make. There's a gadol. Rav Moshe Feinstein had a Talmud. The number one Talmud of Rav Moshe Feinstein was Rav Nissen Halperin. In fact, they were so closely united that within a year of Rav Moshe Feinstein's death, his star Talmud Rav Nissen Halperin passed away. They were very close. Rav Nissen Halperin was able to anticipate everything that Rav Moshe would say. In fact, one time Rav Aaron Kudler called the Beis Midrash to speak to Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Rav Moshe Feinstein was not available. He wasn't there. So Rav Aaron Kudler asked, who is in the Beis Midrash? And they said, Ibn Nissen Alper. He says, alright, put him on the phone. He'll know what Rav Moshe says about this. That is how great of a Talmud Ibn Nissen Alper was. He was able to anticipate and anything his Rebbe would say. He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, very diligent. And at the end of his life, he suffered tremendously from a form of cancer. And when he was in the hospital, and in those days cancer was even more invasive than it is today, back in 1986, when he was in the hospital with tubes attached to many orifices in his body, and needles and all these different types of machines that were just everywhere and disturbed. So his son-in-law came to visit him. And his son-in-law asked him, Abba, he called him Abba, how are you feeling? And Ibn Nissen Alper said, and you can imagine with the scene, with all of the pain, with all of the needles and all of the tubes, he said, it's the Bittul Torah that's killing me. It's the not being able to learn that's getting me down. He didn't care about the tubes, he didn't care about the machines, he didn't care about the needles. What was snapping and draining his life was the inability to enjoy a little bit of a Tosfos, to enjoy a little bit of it. The religious vibrancy is what was giving him life. And what he felt was lacking when he was in the hospital. That's the notion of ha'odenu chai. Okay. We'll do two more. This one's an easy one to throw out there for you.
That one was good. I like this beauty song. I think I'm going to repeat it.
Right. This one's an easy one for you. Okay. Now, I don't know how many of you guys are aware or not, but at the end of every parsha, there is always a count of how many psukim were in the parsha. So for example, in Parshas Miketz, you have 146 psukim. Every parsha has it. And then they give some sort of siman for you to remember it. So for example, 146 equals Yechizkiyahu in Gematria, or Amatzia in Gematria. Okay. Fine. But in all 54 parshas that you have in the Torah, you always have that count of how many psukim were in the parsha. But of all 54, this is the only one where they give us not only the count of the psukim, but also how many words are in the parsha. It never happens. Only in this parsha. They say in this parsha is... what? 2025 words.
Why did it say
that?
What did it tell us in this particular parsha?
We didn't get to that yet. That's an excellent question.
Okay.
So that's an excellent question. So out of all the parshas, you will be hard pressed to find one, save for Parshas Miketz, where they not only list the psukim but even the words. And the words come out to be 2025. Okay. So why? There is two explanations that are given. Okay, one is Hanukkah related, and one is Parsha related. First one, I guess we'll do Hanukkah. Rav Baruch Halevi, the Torah Tmimah, points out the following. He says, on Hanukkah, we light a Ner. A Ner in Gematria, Nun and Aresh, is 250. Multiply 250 by 8 nights is?
2025.
No. 8 times 250 is 2,000. right? 2,000 plus the 25th day of Kislev, Chaf Hei, 25, that's the day that Hanukkah starts. So you get 2,000 plus 25 equals?
2,025.
Parshas Miketz is always, maybe once every 20 years it is not, Parshas Miketz is always on Hanukkah. And so therefore, maybe there's another hint, the reason why they stuck in the 2,025 is as a hint to the 2,025 candles, quote unquote, the Gematria, that we start lighting on the 25th of Kislev. Okay, that's one interpretation. Very nice, that's the Torah Tmima. Another interpretation is the following. We know that when Yosef was in Mitzrayim, so they nicknamed him. Right? So Paro nicknamed him Tzifnat Pa'aneach, but everyone else didn't call him Tzifnat Pa'aneach, rather they called him Avreich. Right, they grew the Avreich. That's in Perek Mem Aleph, Pasuk Mem Gimel. Avreich. So what Avreich? Right. So that's a machlokus. Rashi brings it down. What's Avreich? Rabbi Yehuda says he's Av. Av is an Abba. He's a master of Chochmah, but he's Rach. It's two words. Av. And Rach. He's a master of Chokhmah, but he's Rach, he's soft, he's little in years. And Rabbi Yossi says, what are you talking about? Avreich doesn't mean that he is a father in Chokhmah, a master of Chokhmah, but young in years. Avreich is from the word Berech, knee. Everyone used to crouch down on their knee when he would pass by. Oh. So basically, it ends up being that Rabbi Yehuda reads it as two words, Avreich, and Rabbi Yossi reads it as one word, Avreich, to get down on the knee. So over here, says the Gra, it was important for the Torah to give us a count of how many words there are in the Parsha to know if you're supposed to read Avreich as two words or as one word. The fact that we have 2,025 words means that we read it as one word. If it was Avreich, two words, we would have it 2,026. And that's why they gave us the count, because there was a potential confusion over here if it should be read as two words, Avreich, or is it Avreich, one word.
But maybe it's really 224 if it's one, and 225 if it's two.
Maybe, but if you count, you would see that that's not correct.
Yeah, I hear.
Okay. Fine, there's many more, but we will stop here for now. Enjoy your next class. Yeah.